This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of November the 5th, 2018. I'm Mason King. On Saturday, October 27th, Rabbi Dennis Sasso received a text from his wife, Rabbi Sandy Sasso. Dennis had just completed a morning service at Congregation Bethel Zedek on 70th Street on the north side of Indianapolis. Sandy's text informed him of terrible news.
Shot fired! Shot fired!
The peace of the Sabbath morning shattered by gunfire.
Today, all of Pennsylvania mourns with you.
The case is now being investigated as a hate crime. Bowers is facing federal charges.
A mass shooting with multiple fatalities by an anti-Semitic gunman at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, a synagogue that they knew intimately from earlier in their careers. Now, in that moment, with congregants waiting for him after the service, Dennis knew he needed to respond as a leader. It was a tragic event, but one that would have long-term emotional and even political implications. And in the next several days, both Dennis and Sandy would be called upon to provide solace, context, and counsel for people both in and out of the congregation, as well as set the tone for what will follow. Now, we at the podcast initially wanted to speak with the Sassos to see how the Pittsburgh massacre had affected their congregation and the congregation's sense of safety. But it became clear pretty quickly that they were most concerned with questions of leadership. In an era of extreme political division, what does a responsible leader sound like? How is the tone set by political leaders and their operatives contributed to divisiveness? And what should Indiana legislators consider their most important responsibility when they address whether to pass a hate crimes law in the General Assembly early next year? Here's our conversation with the rabbis Dennis and Sandy, who together have served Congregation Beth El Zedek since 1977. Dennis and Sandy, thank you so much for joining me. Tell me just briefly, when did you first hear about the shooting and got kind of a sense of, you know, the enormity of the tragedy?
I learned about the shooting from Sandy, in fact, immediately after services on Saturday morning. As I entered my study, I noticed that there was a text from her, and I called her, and she apprised me of what had happened during the hours that we were having services here at the synagogue. Mm-hmm. The people had already left chapel and were gathered in the community room. So I headed there and I informed my congregants of what I had just learned. Did not have but scant details at that point.
We had both been interns at actually one of the congregations that met at Tree of Life, Dor Chadash, many years ago when we were in rabbinical school in our
early
years.
And that was meeting there that morning.
The congregation that was meeting there. So we knew people there, and, you know, we paid very close attention to what was happening. And, of course, like the whole Jewish community, we were deeply concerned about what had happened and the hate that had caused
it. I mean, that's amazing that you would have kind of a personal sense of attachment to the area and to those people. And it's really interesting that you actually were working, as it were, when you found out about that. Mm-hmm. So I imagine the pivot going to the place in your head where you think, I have to be a leader here, I have to be able to tell people something, was almost immediate.
First of all, in order to make sure that they would not go out and learn about this individually, since they were as a community, there is a value to processing something like this as a group. So that was my first sense of responsibility.
Yeah. What was that first conversation like, just when you went in and had that first contact with your congregants to tell them?
Well, a feeling of disbelief, a feeling of tremendous anguish and pain, a feeling of, here we go again.
Well, everyone, I'm sure at that point, has got their phone out.
Sure.
And they're trying to figure out what's going on. I mean, it sounds a little chaotic when people are just kind of processing it in the moment. Yeah. I mean, what do you see as your role in that moment?
As a rabbi, I serve as a pastor, you know, ministering to the individual spiritual needs of people, also hopefully as a prophetic voice, helping us to draw teaching and wisdom from the moral tradition, and calling the people both to reflect on the situation, but then to act on the situation.
So I happened to be at an 80th birthday lunch that day, someone who is a long-term member of our congregation, and people were constantly coming over to me to ask what I knew, to share information they had. There seemed to be a need to come together as a community to be more aware of what was going on. I mean, news was just breaking at the time, and everybody was looking at a phone and trying to figure out what they, you know, what they could discern. So, you know, I kind of felt at the center of this, you know, how can I give the correct information? How can I be there as a calming presence, as a pastoral presence, and also how can I speak out in a way that can change the climate of hate in our community?
And in the moment, I mean, how did you approach it? When people, I imagine people were feeling a little panicked.
People were, deeply concerned. And in the moment, you know, as news was breaking, there was very little we could do. We knew that we would need to bring people together to, as a sign of solidarity, as a sign, a way of grieving, of a way of seeking comfort, but also as a way of activating people to move forward, to find ways to create a climate where this is not an everyday event, because it just seemed that we had heard about the pipe bombs and we had just heard about the individual who wanted to shoot up a black church and ended up killing two people of color. I mean, it just seemed like it was kind of a tsunami in many ways, one event after another after another.
So in those first 24 hours, I mean, were a couple of the concrete steps that you took?
Well, immediately we started communicating with other colleagues in the community. That communication eventuated in the service that took place on Monday night at the Indianapolis Hebrew Congregation as an expression of the collective efforts of the Jewish Community Relations Council and the rabbis and congregations in the community. It attracted over 1,200 people. There was a standing room only. It was evident that this incident that took place in Pittsburgh at a synagogue translated into ripples of solidarity and support.
We each received so many emails from people we don't normally correspond with, but who are leaders in their faith communities, who were expressing solidarity and asking, what is it that we can do to be there for you at this time?
I think that one of the things that emerges from this experience is that given the fact that it's not an isolated one and not the only one, that we are experiencing in our country a climate of permissiveness that seems to allow both for oral expressions of denigration and disregard and hatred that often translate into heinous and shameful and harmful acts.
That is a primary concern. I mean, hate speech is so rampant. It's a matter of causing fear among people. By, you know, if you call undocumented immigrants animals, you know, if you demean people, you make it easier for people to act in violent ways because they are no longer human beings like you. You know, they're aliens, you know, they're animals. They're, those kinds of words precipitate certain kinds of actions. And the hate speech is rampant. And so sometimes the hate that was beneath the surface that didn't seem politically correct and we could not express those sentiments are now no longer beneath the surface.
I mean, the president has been criticized a lot for at least seeming to either excuse or kind of wink at or promote kind of a white nationalist agenda, and also to stigmatize, you know, people outside the norm of you know, white America. To what degree, I mean, can we put this at his feet? Is that fair?
I think the responsibility belongs at many levels. And yes, we hear the White House, but also from even the electoral process that we are experiencing before us, expressions that are not only not dignified, but potentially dangerous and harmful. You can't just blame one person, but always the person at the top has to assume particular responsibility.
So we create this atmosphere of we are the Americans and everybody else is the other. And this polarization and this hateful rhetoric is causing this tremendous expression of hatred in our country. But the people at the top, of course, need to model the best kind of conversation.
And I should say that since the events, several people in the political office have contacted and us, and actually we've had several meetings with leading officials who want our input and also who want to assure us of their ongoing support.
What did you tell the political leaders what needs to change?
You know, I spoke to them privately to say we need to change the kind of rhetoric that is coming out from leadership across the board. And we need to call out demeaning speech and vitriol and say this is unacceptable in our country. This is not how we talk to one another.
What drew the largest applause and response was when I referenced that we needed to do something about the proliferation of guns in our country and about the lack of a hate crimes law in our state. That is a tangible reality. That is something that can be done at a very practical level.
And we're expecting a pretty robust, I think, debate at the next Indiana General Assembly about establishing hate crimes law.
Absolutely.
You may not realize this, but we had a hate crimes law in Indiana in 1947.
Yeah, I think I didn't know that. It was repealed, I think, in the 70s.
It was repealed in 1977 as part of the overhaul of the crimes laws.
Right.
But what was interesting, the law that was created and promoted by the governor at the time was in response to the proliferation and the renewal of the Ku Klux Klan in Indiana and neo-Nazi groups. And it was passed easily and quickly. And now here we are with other precipitating events, which we hope would encourage people to finally pass this.
Yeah, how do you think this event kind of changes the calculation on trying to get something like that passed?
Well, it's just another expression of the urgent need to address this.
We actually did a podcast about this when the local business leaders, a group of about 12, came out and said, this is a priority for the business community. So we did a podcast talking about, well, how do you approach a legislator about passing something like this? And we know the skeptics are going to say something akin to this. Hate crimes law would not have stopped a guy from going into a guy who is bent on a murder spree going into a synagogue.
I think that the intent of a hate crimes law is to attach an additional level of punitive result to somebody who provenly commits a crime out of hateful, bigoted relationship to the victim, right? That's not always an easy thing to establish. However, it is a statement by the legislative body of the country, by the state, by the governor, that this is not tolerated, that this is not welcome as the way to behave in this state.
Of course, we can't necessarily stop people from doing certain acts, but we can create a sense that there are certain values that Indiana holds dear, and one of those is the respect for people who are different and the diversity of our community.
To what degree are people feeling less safe?
Jewish folk are, of course, naturally feeling the concern that comes with this, but at the same time, a definite commitment and reaffirmation to the values that undergird this country and to fight for them and to protect them. The first letter written by President George Washington to a Jewish community in the United States in Newport, Rhode Island, says that this is a nation that gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance. And the American Jewish community feels that this is the trajectory and that this is the trajectory that we must keep ahead of us, not only for ourselves, but for other peoples as well.
I was going to say, I think that all minorities are feeling more vigilant and more cautious. I mean, I've heard from people who are legal immigrants, perhaps citizens already, that their children are afraid sometimes in school. Are they going to be singled out? Do they not like, you know, people from Mexico? And there's this, particularly among children, this fear. I mean, our grandchildren have drills for active shooter drills. Well, sure. you can imagine an elementary school children living with this constant fear.
I know you can't speak specifically about what you do here for security, but have your members been interested in improving security here?
That's an issue that we have been addressing over several years, and we feel that we have the best protections in place. We enjoy the support of IMPD and of the sheriff and are in constant consultation with them and also with the other institutions in the Jewish community to provide safety and security to our entire community.
I mean, are you planning on doing anything in addition to what you already do based on what happened?
Always looking to improve and to increase, yes. So we have over the past several weeks, added some surveillance and security, but we continue to look at ways in which to make this an ongoing effort without turning our synagogues and churches and institutions into fortresses.
In modern Indianapolis, are people who are Jewish, do they still experience at least some subtle forms of prejudice? How does that manifest itself?
Yeah, I don't think that they necessarily experience it on a face-to-face, one-on-one basis, but there are subliminal messages. There are things that are said, and as we mentioned earlier, to young people in high schools and even in junior high schools, informal encounters and conversations with people in the community who may not know that you are Jewish and may use some expressions that are classically taken out of the anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic tradition. But I would say that the messages are generic, that they are subliminal, but that they are very, very patent and present in increasing way. So one of the messages that we get from this is to be a little bit more responsible in countering expressions of bigotry, whether they be anti-Semitic or racist or of any other kind.
Mm-hmm. And how do you counter them?
On the spot. When you hear it, on the spot when you hear it, through education. You have to be significantly committed as a state.
I think you need to speak up when you hear hate speech and inappropriate stereotypes being expressed, even in jokes. A lot of times people just, you know, get quiet and walk away. But sometimes people don't recognize that what they're saying is either racist or anti-Semitic. They repeat stereotypes that they've been heard for generations, and they might even welcome a correction. But we need to correct people's speech and say, I do not appreciate hearing this. I don't appreciate hearing this because what you're saying is incorrect. If we don't do that, then we just allow that language and that speech to continue to proliferate. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to underscore the importance of naming something. I mean, if you say, oh, well, that's just funny, or you say that's racist, it's a big difference. We need to name things for what they are so that people are aware that these are dangerous ways of speaking. And we need leaders, you know, religious leaders, political leaders, to model a language that is inclusive and brings us together as a community and that celebrates American values. We don't hear that enough. We don't hear this great oratory that inspired us to be proud of who we are and to work together. We need that to come back again.
Well, Dennis and Sandy, thank you so much.
All right,
best of luck to you and the congregation.
Thank you very much.
My thanks again to Dennis and Sandy. Before you go, I wanted to point out a couple of stories in this week's IBJ. Technology touches nearly every corner of business nowadays, but even the biggest firms can't do it all. That's one big reason why corporate venture capital is on the upswing. Companies like Eli Lilly, Simon Property Group, Allegion, and Salesforce have established firms to invest in tech startups and other newish ventures that can help the mothership. IBJ's Anthony Shetley reports on how this is playing out locally. And also in this week's IBJ, North of 96 reporter Sam Quinn has dialed her focus down to several blocks near the Monon Trail in Carmel that are in the midst of dramatic transformation with new developments and construction projects. You can see it all in the copy of IBJ that you, of course, have delivered to your front door or at IBJ.com. Folks, thanks again for checking out the podcast. I'm Mason King, and we'll be back next week.